Hi, it's Patrick Cox here. What do you know about Sanskrit?
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
We have a Sanskrit pod today in three parts. I could say three acts, but another podcast does acts. So let's say parts. Part one, Sanskrit in the news right now. What makes an ancient scholarly language a possible tool of nationalism? Part two, an American student learns words in Sanskrit that might have shocked the religious masters who originally codified the language. They didn't have a word for telephone back in those days. They do now. Part three, is the Sanskrit alphabet the perfect alphabet? Okay, part one, the politics of Sanskrit. This is a language that's been around in written form for more than 3,000 years. In spoken form, well, who knows, but probably a whole lot longer than that. It's best known for its religious texts, both Hindi and Buddhist texts. But, oh dear, mix language and religion, bake it for a few thousand years, and out of the oven pops politics. Yes, ugly old politics. Which is a shame, because Sanskrit as a language is far from ugly. But there is renewed interest in Sanskrit right now, and there is a political context to some of it. Not all of it, as you'll hear later in the pod, but certainly some of it. The ruling party of India, elected last year, is the BJP, the Hindu Nationalist Party. And these guys, they have a thing about Sanskrit. They want the language supported more than it has been in the past. It already enjoys quite a bit of protection. It's one of India's 22 official languages, even though the number of native speakers is minuscule compared to, well, all 21 others and a whole bunch of other ones that aren't recognized as official languages. But Sanskrit is closely associated today in India with the Hindu religion, which is why several incoming Hindu nationalist members of parliament took their oath of office after the elections last year in Sanskrit. And one of the very first things the new government introduced was Sanskrit Week in schools. This is a week given over to the study of Sanskrit language and the culture that's associated with it. And this has not gone down well with non-Hindus, or for that matter, with anyone who believes in the idea of a pluralistic India, a secular India. So that is Sanskrit today, an ancient language that's left us with the odd word like karma or guru, but otherwise uses largely obscure terminology. This kind of, you'd almost say, technical religious language. It also carries a ton of baggage in today's India. Okay, having wallowed in the fetid pool of identity politics, I'm dragging myself out of it and yanking Sanskrit out too. What follows, and we're now entering part two, what follows is what you might call an experiment in language learning. Patricia Sautoff is a doctoral student studying tantric literature and social history in medieval Kashmir. For that, she needs Sanskrit. She has to be able to read it. But Patricia decided she wanted a bit more. She wanted to try to study it, not as a dead or near-dead language, but as a living one. Here she is.
I want to speak Sanskrit, not read it or translate it, but use it to express myself in the everyday world, like this. I started studying Sanskrit as a written language a few years ago. Back then, when I told people about it, they assumed I was a big White Album-era Beatles fan or into transcendental meditation. Now they assume I spend a lot of time doing yoga. It's clear that Sanskrit has been lingering at the edges of Western culture for a while now. It's an obscure language that not many people know, but a lot of people know about. It's impossible to say how many Sanskrit speakers there are in India. According to the 2001 census, about 14,000 people claimed it as their mother tongue, and we don't know how many Indians speak it as their second or third language. The latest census results aren't out yet, but it looks like interest in Sanskrit is rebounding, and the rise of Hindu nationalism is part of that. Certainly the study of Sanskrit is surging in popularity, in India and in the West. Recently, students at Princeton University launched a petition to get Sanskrit back into the curriculum. And in my own school, the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, the second-year Sanskrit course grew from 2 students last year to nearly 20 this year. These classes mostly focus on reading and translating, but proper pronunciation and composition are always part of the learning process. To spend a month speaking Sanskrit, though, is something quite different. The books I read are about philosophy, but in this class I learn how to say things like telephone, durabhasha, and bicycle, dvichakrika. Speaking in Sanskrit day in and day out is pretty surreal. This language that I've been learning to read for years suddenly comes off the page and surrounds me. It forces me to interact with it in a completely different way. Most importantly, it reminds me that Sanskrit isn't just a language of dusty books. And as anyone who's ever namasteed knows, it's a language that's really fun to say out loud and to sing.
Vyasa virachita Ganesha likhita Mahabharate puniya katha.
That's me and my classmates. There were 20 of us, learning, speaking, and singing 6 days a week for 4 weeks. Several of my classmates were Indians living in Europe. Some were grad students like myself, and others were professionals taking a break from work. There was a Buddhist monk who out-chanted us all. Much like any other intensive language course, we're expected to communicate only in Sanskrit. But where other immersion courses are for beginners, most of my classmates had years of experience reading the language. Slowly translating a written work and rapid-fire conversation are, of course, completely different. Those who spoke Hindi, Bengali, or Gujarati found the spoken Sanskrit a little more familiar than those of us who just read. We learned to speak through traditional methods like singing and chanting. But also by discussing everyday things. We learned lines of ancient poetry and had a Skype chat in Sanskrit with a professor in Australia. It's actually pretty easy to hear Sanskrit out in the world, if you know where to look. There are Sanskrit language newscasts, I've seen Shakespeare and other plays performed in Sanskrit here in London, and there's a community of language learners and teachers from around the world who gather on Twitter to share their knowledge, ask for help, and meet others interested in communicating in Sanskrit. Some are in India, some are part of the Indian diaspora, and some, like me, are Westerners interested in learning something more about the language and culture of South Asia. Around the world, the study of Sanskrit is growing. Distance learning programs, language competitions, and the ease of sharing materials online make it easier than ever to access the language. The students in my class are aware that the revival of Sanskrit is contentious. Events like the newly introduced Sanskrit Week are seen as privileging one language and culture over others. India's second largest religion, Islam, does not have historical ties to Sanskrit. And even among Hindus, the country's largest religious group, Sanskrit learning has historically been something for only the privileged castes.
Yat tat.
Ya sarvada hasati samaria.
Samaria.
In the classroom, we aren't discussing the current debates or the history of language. Instead, we're practicing for an upcoming performance of songs and a play for friends, family, and the Indian ambassador to Germany. While most of us are studying Sanskrit in order to read it, learning to speak it opens up a new way to think about the language and a stronger understanding of how the works we're trying to read were composed. Learning to speak Sanskrit has been a challenge. My vocabulary includes a lot of technical, philosophical terms that aren't easy to translate into English, but now some useful everyday ones too. I'm used to being able to slowly read complex books, but when it comes to quickly answering a basic question, like Kushalam Asti Va, how are you? I freeze. I finally realize after a month of trying that for me, Sanskrit isn't about self-expression. It's about reading the ideas of the past. I'm glad I've gotten to experience it as a living language, even if I'm more comfortable treating it as a dead one. For the world, I'm Patricia Southoff.
Surasa Subodha Vishva Manojna Lalita Ridya Ramaniya Amrita Vani Samskrita Bhasha Naiva Krishna Chakatina Naiva Krishna Chakatina Naiva Krishna Chakatina.
Okay. Diving even further into Sanskrit now, into the alphabet, with Terence Coe. Terence is a translator by profession, a German to English translator, but he's also been studying Sanskrit for about a decade. He loves many aspects of the language, but he told me he has a particular admiration for the unique qualities of the Sanskrit alphabet.
The fascinating thing about the Sanskrit alphabet is that it has a logical structure to it, which is unlike any other alphabet in the world. It's arranged according to the mechanism, the human vocal mechanism. The language itself is structured in a way that reflects how sound is produced in the mouth. And the ancient phoneticians, the Sanskrit phonetics goes back more than 5,000 years and is embedded in the ancient literature itself. And it defines different points of articulation in the mouth, where sound is produced. They analyzed how sound is produced in the mouth. And the alphabet itself reflects these principles.
And when you say they, who were they?
In the tradition, the Vedas, which are the ancient books of knowledge, the world's oldest knowledge tradition, were transmitted, so to speak, by people we call rishis. The word rishi itself means one who sees, one who knows. And according to the tradition, they saw the underlying reality of the world, and they communicated this through what we call mantras, which are the basis of the Vedas. And this is an oral tradition. When did it start? We don't know. It's an oral tradition. It goes back beyond, far predates the written language. According to tradition, it is a beginningless. It came with the creation itself. But then you're getting into the realm of theology, not linguistics. From a linguistic point of view, there are many different theories about where Sanskrit comes from, but no one really knows for sure.
So the alphabet itself, how many letters are there? And as you say, they were organized according to sound. So yes. How was that then transcribed?
The transcription, the beautiful thing about Sanskrit, it's an oral language. It was passed through an oral tradition. So the written characters reflect the way the language is spoken. It's a purely phonetic language. The alphabet itself follows a structure. It begins with the vowels. So you start with simplest vowel, you open your mouth, make a sound, So is the first vowel. R. And it goes through the simple vowels, then the diphthongs, a-o-i-ao. And then we begin with the consonants, ka, ga, ga, nga. Then we proceed to the next consonants, which are cha, cha, ja, ja, nga. Next is what we call the cerebral, also retroflex, because the tongue curls back and touches the top of the mouth. You get ta, ta, da, da, na, a very distinctive sound among Indian speakers of English, but we don't have that sound in our American or Western English. And then the dental, ta, ta, da, da, na, then labial, pa, pa, ba, ba, ma. So you hear this repeating sequence going on. That's in the alphabet itself, going from a ka, which is unvoiced, unaspirated, to ka, where some air comes out, aspirated. Ka, ka. Then you engage the voice box. Ga, ga. And then nga, you add the nose. This sequence repeats for all the rest of the consonants. Then you bring in the semi-vowels. So ya, ra, la, va. Then the sibilants, sha, sha, sa, and an aspirate, ha. And there you have your entire alphabet.
Yeah, that's so straightforward and so brilliant that it makes you wonder why more languages don't have something similar. I mean, it's not as if Sanskrit is a recent language. It's been around as an example for a very long time.
Very true. And one of the things that fascinated me when I first was exposed to this is I started looking at my own language, my own alphabet, and I started thinking, why is our alphabet in the order it's in? A, B, C, D, E, F, G. What is the logical principle underlying our own alphabet? And it turns out there isn't one. Our alphabet is in its order because that was based on the Latin alphabet from the Greek, goes back to the Phoenicians, and actually goes back to the Egyptians. But the particular order, there's no logic underlying it. You've got a vowel here, a vowel there, semi-vowel here, semi-vowel there, hard consonants, soft consonants, nasals, all mixed up. But the fascinating thing about Sanskrit, it's a natural language, and this is the alphabetical order that comes with the language itself.
What about some of the languages that are rooted in Sanskrit? Have they classified their alphabets in similar ways?
Yes, all the Indian languages, all the major Indian languages, if you look at their alphabets, they're either exactly corresponding to the Sanskrit language, like Hindi, Marathi, Gujarati, all the major languages. The major language in South India is Tamil. They have the same general structure, but they don't make certain sound distinctions. So there you can see the relationships between all these languages and Sanskrit.
So what does that do to an outsider who's learning the language? How does it compare to, I mean, you're a German specialist, how does it compare to learning German?
German was a great help for me in this. I also studied Russian in college, and I was amazed when I started learning Sanskrit that certain things seemed very familiar to me, and I realized that the Slavic languages are very close to Sanskrit in terms of their structure. We have what's called inflection in Sanskrit, something we don't have in English, which is when I say a sentence, for example, if I say, dog bites man, you have a subject, verb, and an object. If I say man bites dog, it means something quite different. The meaning has changed because your word order has changed. Why? Because we depend upon word order because we have no way of knowing which word is the subject and which is the object in the sentence. In Sanskrit, as in German and Russian and some of these other languages, we call them inflected. There's a marker put on the end of the word, an ending put on the end of the word that tells you this is the subject, this is the object. So Sanskrit has 8 of these cases. In other words, they can take into account different relationships between the words and the verb. Is it the subject? Is it the object? Is it the means by which something is being done? Is it the person for whom something is being done? Is it the source of something happening? Is it the location where it's happening? Is it a possession relationship? All these things are taken into account in the Sanskrit. So they have 7 what we call cases, plus 1 the vocative case. German has 4. Russian has 7. So I had some familiarity with this concept, and seeing how much further Sanskrit went than beyond even German, which is already a difficult language for many people to learn, it was a great help for me in viewing how languages communicate meaning at various levels of precision. Sanskrit is an incredibly precise language.
Right. Yeah, so the alphabet, the precision of the alphabet is just a reflection of the overall precision of the language.
Yes, exactly. The language itself is precise down to the level of how a sound is made.
Well, how about translating Sanskrit? How easy is it to translate a language like that?
Actually, I'm starting my first attempt at translating a Sanskrit work. It's very difficult because Sanskrit being an ancient language, meaning or shades of meaning have been added to words through the literature. Because Sanskrit literature is an ocean, we have the 4 Vedas. Then you have the commentaries written on these works. Then you have the what's called the Puranic literature, the ancient stories, the mythologies, if you will. Then you have these works which relate to the different sciences, the different arts. All these, this field of literature using this same basic language has expanded the meanings of some of these words, built upon them. And so one word can have potentially a lot of different meanings. The language is context-based, and you've got an ocean of context there to work with. How do I find exactly the right meaning for this word? It takes a very careful examination of the specific context in which the word is being used, and a very good understanding of, again, the grammatical base for the word. So it's tricky, which is probably why most of the Sanskrit works have never been translated.
And what is it that you are translating?
I'm working on a short book by a gentleman who lived about 100 years ago, and it is a treatise on sort of the heart of the philosophy of Vedanta. Vedanta is the texts which come at the end of the Vedas, hence Veda, Anta, Anta meaning end, the Vedanta, these works which come at the end of the Vedas, which discuss the reality of this jagat, this world that we face. Many Eastern philosophies, Buddhism and so forth, have all risen from this. It's an examination of reality, the reality of the world, the reality of oneself, the reality of what you call God. If there's a cause here, what is the nature of that cause? What is the nature of the world I confront? So it's delving into the deepest philosophical aspects, which is what drew me to the language. I didn't study the language for its own. I was drawn to it for this study, but then I found that the language itself actually reflects this. If you look at the Sanskrit alphabet, the first letter is a. The last letter is ha. The Sanskrit word for I, first person singular, is aham. A-ha-hm. You've taken the first sound, and the last sound, and then you finish by closing the mouth, aham, which means all sounds come from you, really. They all come from the I, the self. You're the source of all language. It means you're the source of all meaning. And in the Upanishad itself, a very famous excerpt from one of the lessons there, Vacharambanam vikaro namadeyam mrittiketyeva satyam. All this world that you perceive, that you know, is words. It comes from words. All the meaning arises out of words. And those words all come from you. Aham. It all comes from you. So the language itself, the alphabet itself, is telling you something very profound.
Well, I mean, not even on a good day could I think of myself in those terms, but there you go. That's magnificent. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
And that Vedanta philosophy book that Terence Koh mentioned, that is awaiting publication right now. He has another book on Vedanta, whose title I'm not going to try and pronounce, that's just been published. And that's it for this time. Thanks for listening. There's more on Sanskrit at pri.org/language, or if you prefer, the World in Words Facebook page. I'm on Twitter. My handle there is Patricox, PatriCox. And don't forget to check out all the other podcasts at soundworks.org. I'll be back soon.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.